It is 27 days until Election Day, which makes it 28 days at least until there's a relief package. So what do you suppose that's going to be like in this economy that month or so? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 7th of October. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We are not going to hazard a guess here about what is going to happen with negotiations on an economic relief bill. The negotiations that the president shut down yesterday afternoon and then tried to restart piecemeal last night. What we are going to do is deal with the facts as we have them now, which is that there are no negotiations, and that as far as anybody knows, there is no help coming for this economy till after the election and maybe longer. So that being the case, two stories today on that topic, and then a political insight. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with story number one, the economic big picture.
Back in March, Washington sent $3 trillion coursing through the economy's veins. One of the biggest infusions was $600 a week in extra unemployment payments to more than 20 million jobless Americans. That expired in mid-summer, and George Washington University economist Jay Shamba says the amount of cash going out to laid-off workers cratered.
It fell from $110 in July to $34 billion in September. So there's this massive drop-off to the economy and also to the most vulnerable households.
Those $1,200 relief checks from the spring have been spent, with most of the federal pandemic relief now gone.
We've seen a slowing of retail sales and personal spending.
Joseph Bruswellis at RSM Consulting says a quarter of small businesses have closed. He predicts without more federal support, including lending to small businesses, more will fail. And state and local governments won't be able to keep teachers and other essential workers on the payroll, says Michael Gratz at Columbia Law School.
The loss of civil service jobs will disproportionately affect minorities because they've been hired into those jobs.
Bottom line, says Dan North at credit insurer Euler Hermes North America.
Okay, let's say we don't have a stimulus package. The economy gets pretty severely damaged in the short term, probably 4 or 5 years to get back to full employment.
The burden is falling to families that are running out of time and money, says Columbia's Michael Gratz.
People are facing evictions, difficulty paying for food and lodging. This is a desperate situation.
One that the chaos in Washington isn't making any better. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So there is a cost to the economy of all this politicking, as Mitchell was telling us. There are also real big personal costs. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has story number two.
Chester Englander is an orchestra percussionist living in Ohio. He was unemployed for much of this year, so was his musician wife. They have two small children, and he was getting $600 a week in federal unemployment benefits from April to July.
I added $6,000 credit card debt to my one card, and it was clear, like, you know, things were deteriorating incredibly fast.
He's used the credit card to pay for food, mortgage, utilities. His parents, in their 70s, recently had to pitch in. For a lot of Americans, the economic crisis means drawing unemployment and wiping out savings, like Chris Dancy in Texas.
I mean, our savings was eviscerated. Even with mortgage deferments and lots of plans, you can't stop your spending fast enough.
Dancy is a health consultant who has been unemployed since the pandemic began. His husband is a school teacher who is still working. But with only one income, Dancy is nervous about the future. So is Cristobal Morris, who has had to defer his dream of buying a house. He works in the New York film industry and was without income for much of the year. Morris is now employed again, but as the city sees a new rise in COVID cases, Morris says,
"My biggest fear right now is if we have another shutdown in the next month and there is no additional government assistance, then we definitely will have to go start tapping into our savings again."
He says he's always tried to set money aside for a rainy day, but he's worried about how many more rainy days he and his family will have to weather. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Okay, now the political insight into all of this, namely how we wound up empty-handed after four-something months of negotiations. It comes to us from Politico's Jake Sherman on MSNBC this morning.
Markets are woefully uneducated about Washington.
Those markets, as you know, have been on a roll since the end of March, in part because of the CARES Act, and in part because of the hopes for another relief bill, which has eased some of the pressure, a lot of the pressure, on lawmakers to deal.
This is idiocy. These people on Wall Street should spend a day in Washington and talking to people, because they are just completely out of their minds.
Or in other words, there was never going to be a deal, or hopes were faint at best, and Wall Street should have known it.
These people in any other business, Wall Street analysts who have been putting 90% on a stimulus deal, any other business would be put away for fraud. I mean, it's just complete nonsense. Anybody with a brain understood this.
And then today what happens? Negotiations are torpedoed by the White House, and Wall Street says, hey, no, yeah, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consider the modern American grocery store. Aisles and aisles of almost every product you can think of. Really kind of a miracle of logistics and of productivity and of consumer choice. And now in this virus economy, it has to be said, not without hazard for those consumers and especially those grocery store workers. There is more, though, to how the grocery industry really operates in this country than meets the eye. And that is the story that Benjamin Lohr tells in his new book. It's called The Secret Life of Groceries. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Total pleasure.
It's good to have you on. I want to know, I want to know a lot of things, because this is it's kind of a disquieting book. But you start with a scene, as it were, of the fish counter at Whole Foods, where you had taken a job to, you know, do research for this book. And you talk about the cleanup at night, and you say it's, in essence, the perfect metaphor for the grocery business. And I need you to explain that.
Yes, it is an arresting image. Yeah. And metaphor, olfactory more than anything. Essentially, the whole fish counter at Whole Foods is glamorous. It is hygienic and clean in appearance and hygienic and clean in results. However, every month or so, we would be asked to clean it. And by the time you got to the bottom, the debris of the retail surface had fallen down there. This being fish, it smelled horrendous. And to me, that dichotomy, that difference between what was on the retail surface and what you're presented with as a consumer and the underbelly beneath it of these rotting fish guts, really was an apt way of thinking about the grocery store itself and the way the consumer experience sometimes masks things less savory underneath.
Let's dig into that a little bit, because there's a bunch of great threads to pull in this book. One of them is how tough it is for food entrepreneurs, people doing food startup-y things, to get a yes. foothold, especially now that the big food companies are getting bigger. And the thing, obviously, that happened while you were reporting this book was Amazon buying Whole Foods.
Yeah. So that was I think a lot of us walk around in our head with this idea, oh, I make a great guacamole. If I ever took the time, I'd be able to like put it in a bottle and it would do gangbusters. And that was not the case. I followed around a really hardworking, intelligent woman named Julie Boucher, who is marketing kind of a quirky product, Slossa, the combination coleslaw and salsa. And she was caught in a grind. It was really the biggest hurdle she faced. One of the biggest hurdles was the grocery store itself, which was operating far more like a landlord leasing out space and constantly coming after her for payments for appearing in the store, rather than as like a neutral platform to sell the best, most interesting condiments.
It doesn't sound like a landlord. It sounds like a strong arm. I mean, right?
Yeah. And actually, probably the most common of these are slotting fees, which is just a cash payment for inches on the shelf. But they, you know, it does come in other means, like free cases of food or just ticky-tacky fees like in-store promotional radio networks that they pledge that you'll be able to be advertised on, which of course is going to do nothing for your sales, but is rocket fuel to their bottom line when you pay them some amount of cash and then they let you in to the store.
Before I go on, did you try this salsa stuff?
I did. And it was delicious. Okay. I wouldn't feature any product that I thought was horrendous.
Fair enough. All right. So look, let's get to where we are today with grocery stores, right? Because we know the pandemic has changed supply chains. It has made life more difficult for grocery workers, not that they needed life to be more difficult. Do you imagine that these changes are at least semi-permanent? I mean, what's your guess over the next year as this virus plays out?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think we had all these flash changes where everyone went and built their little bomb shelter pantries of canned goods and then went into some national home ec moment where we all made sourdough together. Those are obviously temporary changes. What I think is more permanent is this just accelerated the transfer to online that was already happening, but now has happened in a material way and was going to happen in a structural way where dark stores, which is the industry term for stores that aren't customer facing, don't have a retail floor, but exist to stock goods and fulfill online orders are going to come on in a much more real way. Of course, that's going to have effects on labor that is all too often out of sight, out of mind.
It's a book called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Benjamin Lohr wrote it. Ben, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
We've got an excerpt from Ben's book on our website about some of the inventions that made modern grocery stores possible. You can check that out at marketplace.org. Also, what are you doing tomorrow morning, early? Check out the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the gang, all you need to know to start your economic day. Coming up.
Now I've got two-thirds of a front tooth.
Makes it hard to smile your way through this economy, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here you go. The Dow Industrial's up 530 points, 1.9%, 28,303. The NASDAQ up 209, that is 1.8%, finished at 11,364. The S&P 500 added 58 points, 1.7%. 3,419. Stocks, as I said, rallied, but Jasmine was giving us some details on how some people are managing with no relief in sight. Right now, this is from the Brookings Institution, child hunger in the United States is at unprecedented levels. Brookings says an estimated 17 million kids in this country don't have enough to eat. Its research suggests a 15% boost in supplemental nutrition benefits would get more food to more kids. So Bree was talking airlines, right? American and United each picked up 4.3% today. Delta nosed up about 3.5%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.78%. This is going to sound ridiculous, but that's the highest it's been in a while. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a tidbit in the president's tweeted backtracking last night that we wanted to touch on. He said he would sign a $25 billion aid package for airlines were it to be passed and presented to him. And that is on top of the $25 billion that it's already been spent on airlines. And yes, they are suffering in this pandemic, but so are a lot of other industries, right? So why is it that airlines are special? Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishore.
Airlines are a big industry, for sure. They generate almost $2 trillion in economic activity. They employ around 450,000 people. They're indirectly tied to 10 million jobs.
If we're going to jumpstart the economy, the country needs to be able to move people and goods.
William Swellbar is a research engineer at MIT's International Center for Air Transportation. It's a case that's convinced lawmakers at least once this pandemic. But among critical industries, airlines have unique clout.
They provide service to just about every congressman's jurisdiction.
Richard Squire is professor of law at Fordham.
They are able to threaten to deny service or terminate service to smaller airports.
In fact, one of the conditions of the first airline relief package was that service not be interrupted to a long list of airports. Squire says it meant some flights flew empty or nearly empty. Airlines also spend heavily in Washington with the hope of preserving a special status. Samuel Engel is senior vice president with consulting firm ICF.
Last year, the U.S. airlines spent over $100 million on lobbying.
And he says that was ramped up this year. Airline employees wield influence too, says Tom Cochen, professor at MIT's Sloan School. That's because they're heavily unionized.
And so the unions join the companies in promoting and lobbying for support as well.
It's worth pointing out, too, that the government has a long history of supporting airlines. The government set prices and routes before 1978, and it was part of the Federal Aviation Administration's mandate to promote airlines up until the 1990s. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Starting a new job can be exciting, yes, but also a little bit nerve-wracking, especially so when the job is by definition in person, in a pandemic, in a city where the virus has been hit pretty hard.
My name is Debbie Snacks. I am a tattooer and a muralist in Atlanta, Georgia. So tattooing in Atlanta it's cliquish. It's segregated. In like the biggest black mecca where they say this is black Hollywood, you know, tattooing is still very segregated. And I will say the pandemic and all of the protesting, it's opening people's eyes a bit. It's allowing them to see the lack of representation in their spaces. Because I mean, there's a lane for black tattooers in Atlanta. I think I've carved out a little nook for myself. I like to think that as traditional art is just the black representation of that. I took a break and jumped out because, I mean, Atlanta has been nuts. I ask these questions to my clients, like, hey, what do you do? Like, what have you been doing during quarantine? One of my clients was like, oh no, I didn't quarantine at all. She's like, oh, I've been at the club. I've been, you know, in the sections, it's not so bad. I was like, are there any masks? Like, are you wearing a mask? She was like, no, it's all cool. And then after that, I was like, okay, that's it for me. I need a break. I spent a good amount of time in New York, about a month. Now I'm back in Atlanta, and my books are like really full, and I think that's awesome. But it's also really scary. Luckily, like, I moved to a new shop, and my shop is really on top of it. Like, you know, wash your hands. We're checking temperatures. This is my first time working at a shop with all white people, and me being the only black person there. So I was extremely nervous about it. So I spent my time in New York just really prepping for that, like drawing and painting and just getting my stuff together. I mean, I didn't really need to take that time because it's been so easy, but I mean, I think that it helped that I did just so that I could be ready. I feel like I'm more prepared to move forward. Not only is it a new environment as far as like the color of people or like what their races are, but it's also like just a push for my art.
Debbie Snacks, her art is Tattoo in Atlanta. Tell us your story, would you? Marketplace.org/myeconomy is where you can do that. The unfortunate reality of this society is that appearances count, actually how you look. And among a whole lot of other things, it can give clues about where you fall in this economy. There are things you can control, what you wear, for instance, but there are some things that are, or that can feel anyway, impossible to hide. A study from the American Dental Association shows nearly 1 in 3 low-income adults say their teeth affect their ability to interview for and get jobs. Marketplace's Rima Kreis. She is the host of our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, brings us the story of the financial consequences of a smile.
When Ryan Jones was a kid, she was playing with a friend when he accidentally hit her in the mouth. Pretty badly.
Now I've got like two-thirds of a front tooth. If I smiled, you saw it.
Her parents couldn't afford to fix her chipped teeth or give her consistent dental care. By the time she was an adult, her teeth were brown and she had a lot of tooth decay. Medicaid didn't cover it, so fixing her teeth would cost at least $3,000. She was a single mom with a newborn working odd jobs. She did not have that kind of money.
Then I started going to interviews for better jobs, more professional jobs, tech support type things and IT industry things.
At these interviews, she'd vibe with the interviewer, feel like they were really getting along.
And then suddenly they would get awkward again. There would be that stiff, we're not clicking. And I didn't understand why.
And then were you getting any of these jobs?
No. The year my son was born, I went to over 30 interviews.
Interview after interview, things would start off really well. Then, out of nowhere, she could just feel the air getting sucked out of the room.
And I realized it's when we start joking. That's when I smiled. That's when I relaxed and really smiled.
Huh.
Crap, it's my teeth.
Yeah, it seemed when the interviewer saw her teeth, everything went south. There was one interview that's hard to forget. Ryan felt like she was a shoo-in for this telecommunications job. She was overqualified. A friend had even recommended her to the boss. But like always, she didn't get it. So she got her friend to ask, what happened?
And the response to him was, she's really thin. And have you seen her teeth? You know, they thought that I was a meth addict. And they weren't going to hire a meth addict.
Hearing those words, it stung.
I remember my face felt like really warm. It was definitely shame. And then I was like really angry at this guy that I'd interviewed with.
Here was cold, hard evidence that just glancing at her teeth led this guy to make all these other stereotypes associated with being poor, like that Ryan was dirty or on drugs.
When my friend told me that, I was mad for a moment and then realized I would have assumed the same thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For years, Ryan tried setting aside money to fix her teeth, but it was never enough. Then in her mid-20s, her grandma told her she'd foot the bill as long as Ryan paid her back $100 at a time.
This was my chance up. So, like, look in a mirror and smile and not feel bad about how I look. This is my chance to maybe get this better job.
It's been 19 years since she got her teeth pulled and replaced with dentures. And since then, she's moved her way up the corporate ladder and became an IT engineer. And maybe that would have happened regardless, but Ryan says she owes some of that success to her new teeth.
Honestly, I think maybe good teeth is the standard, and not having that signifies the opposite things. It's not that having good teeth signifies you're a good person, but having bad teeth says bad things about you.
Decades later, Ryan still has stress dreams about having, quote-unquote, bad teeth.
I have this emotional attachment to good teeth. And the thought of not having them again, it scares me, actually.
She says society often tells us that being poor is bad or that it's your fault. And teeth are tied up in this. They aren't usually seen as a reflection of larger issues like poverty or inequalities in dental access. And the result is that every day we make snap judgments of people based on ideas that are flawed and full of stereotypes, like what someone's smile says about their worth. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
You can hear the rest of Ryan's story, some of the hoops she had to go through to get her teeth actually replaced, when you subscribe to This Is Uncomfortable, wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, in which the market is giving us something I'm not sure we need. Saw this yesterday, forgot to mention it. It's a footwear co-branding. Sneaker-looking things from Cole Haan. Canvas tops, it looks like. Bright, bold colors for the soles. Branded with the Slack logo on the outside of the heel. Yes, Slack. That's Slack. I mean, they don't look terrible, but I'm not sure I get it. All right, we're going, but here is your midweek moment of economic context. It comes to us from the Federal Reserve, as does a bunch of this kind of economic research, by the way. For the sixth month in a row, consumer borrowing fell in August. Makes sense, right? Pandemic reality has been settling in. Government aid has gone away. You know the rest. Amir Bimbawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.